nature of universes. Consciously, we all expand and 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 expand.
Well, welcome to Yoga Radio Sessions again. Christian Wiegert.
I'm here.
My left side, and me, Kurt Lundberg, and we have a guest today, Tim Casper, Timothy.
That's great.
Welcome, yeah.
Thank you so much.
I think I should let Christian here present our guest today.
Well, I would like to ask first, how are you today?
I'm great. Thank you
Great.
For asking.
So we invited you here because you are a yoga teacher and you have, as I would say all yoga people, you have your root into yoga. Mm-hmm. So what was your first contact with yoga?
Oof. Well, just to add to what you said, besides teaching yoga, I also do teach Pilates and gyrotonic expansion system. I have in the past for many, many, many years also taught dance and theater. So movement has been at the center of my life for a very, very long time. And my dance career and my teaching was probably the biggest reason and factor that led me to yoga. For many years I had injuries from a lack of full understanding of my instrument, abusing my body, you know, pushing it to limits that I couldn't control because my ego was saying.
May I ask you, Tim, you were a classical dancer,
ballet? I'd studied classical ballet, I studied modern dance, contemporary dance, jazz dance, and musical theater. I would say I spent the majority of my career, particularly the last great portion, doing musical theater.
All right.
Choreographing and directing as well. But I was always very curious. I wanted to try everything. I wanted to taste everything. This has kind of been a bit of a mantra for me, my life. I want to try everything.
An expanding person.
And, well, and explore, and through that exploration, gain better clarity. And understand who I really am instead of who I believed I was or was supposed to be, how I was supposed to live my life.
And you're from Chicago?
Originally. I grew up in Chicago.
Yeah, and that's quite a cold city, isn't it?
Yeah.
The winter's
colder than here, but yeah, the winters are brutal. Mm-hmm. Heavy wind, yeah. So, but I lived there until I was 17. Then we moved to Las Vegas.
Wow.
Big change. Big transition. I went kicking and screaming.
Why?
Lot of resistance already.
Why?
I could have used yoga then. Why? It's 17, it's a tricky age. I had my roots already starting to grow, and I had been to Las Vegas visiting family over the years, so I knew it wasn't my thing.
Why?
Well, first of all, the desert is not my favorite. I love green. I love, you know, plant life. I love the water. I grew up next to the Lake Michigan. Beautiful. I was always around water and green, and I love autumn and spring.
That's why you are in Sweden, I think.
I'm absolutely. That's certainly one of the things that I appreciated about it, the water, the contact with nature, even in the city. You can't go far without connecting with nature, giving you an opportunity to connect with yourself.
But you had to move because your parents got work in Las Vegas.
My mother moved us to be closer to my grandparents. Mm-hmm. So I spent a few years there. It was a learning experience, as all things are. Yeah. So the quicker we give up the resistance and surrender to the experience, the quicker we begin to benefit from.
But it's more usual. It's more common in the States that people move. They change their work. They get a new job and they mm-hmm. move to somewhere else. What? So you grew up with your mother and
single
father.
Single mom. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. I met my father when I was 35.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. I found him through some research.
Yeah.
Made the phone call, shaking in my boots. And we talked for about an hour on the telephone, and it was great, actually. It was quite different than what I expected. And then we met one time after that, and that experience was completely different than the phone call. I think that distance and anonymity allowed for an easier communication. So when we were face to face, he just sort of froze. mm-hmm. And he basically just wasn't there, didn't say much. So that sort of, I learned from that too, that, okay, I need to just accept this. And it's fine. And he is who he is, and he's on his path, and he has to deal with what he has to deal with. And I didn't really miss much, because there wasn't much to have, to gain from that relationship. And I have plenty other relationships and plenty other role models, and I can put my energy where it's productive.
And what did your mother do? What does she do?
Oh, well, she's retired now. Mm-hmm. Now she'll be 75 this year. Big landmark for her. What did she do?
A croupier.
She did work for many, many years in Las Vegas in the casinos. Mm-hmm. Selling change. She wasn't a croupier, but yeah. And it gave her an opportunity to socialize, which is something that she does very well. And she was quite content doing that. And then for the last several years of her career, she was actually working for like a free press newspaper. Yeah, mm-hmm. doing with classified ads and things like that, which I think she also enjoyed.
You have a lot of music theater in Las Vegas?
No. That was there's
shows.
A little more now.
I mean
there's more now, but yeah. There were shows absolutely, and I did. I did actually, at the time, the biggest show there was. We were 100 people on stage in the finale, so it was a large cast. 13 shows a week, working till 2 in the morning, and you know, it was a strange life, sleeping till noon. But yeah. I knew from the beginning that I wouldn't be there for very long, and I gave it a shot, and I thought I need to go further. I need to challenge myself, and I missed the theatrical experience. I was, you know, it was very presentational, but it wasn't very challenging and deep, and so I ended up getting an offer to move to Paris, and I moved to Paris, and I lived in Paris for 4 years, and that's where I continued my technical studies, dance studies, and became more aware of how little technique I actually had and why I was often injured. And,
you know. But that's like really tough, the ballet stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, like I said, the ballet, of course, I took for foundation. And we understand that in yoga as well, how important the foundation work is to the practice. And from, you know, there's always a classic technique that's important for any artist or performer that allows you a better access to your gift and to what you have to express and to say. And from there, you can go in whichever direction you choose, and you take that foundation with you. And so, after Paris, I moved to New York, another big city. And I was there for a little over 20 years. And that's where I encountered yoga. And I think, getting back to your question, what led me to yoga, as I said, were the injuries. But beyond that, I knew, I always felt intuitively, and I don't know why, that there was something for me in yoga, and it scared the crap out of me.
Why?
Because I knew it.
Mm-hmm.
I knew it in my gut and in my heart.
Yeah, but what scared you? What scared
Well,
you?
Because I knew there would be a big process, and it would put me in, it would confront me with the truth and with a deeper sense and responsibility for my existence, for my experiences. Yeah, I was going to have to leave the victim behind,
mm-hmm.
and realize how much I was participating and inviting stress and trauma, and you know, I knew it was going to be a road, and I had to fasten my seatbelt. And eventually I did. And I think, you know, we all are led to yoga for various reasons, but it all comes down to the fundamental, you know. How solid is my base? How rooted am I? How much ease and freedom and joy do I experience in my life?
Well, was the spiritual side something that attracted you, or was it the more...
Yeah, absolutely. I was raised a Catholic. I was definitely raised with a spiritual practice, with all that that entails. There's a lot of control, a lot of dogma, which there is in all spiritual practices, and we have to sift through that and see through that. And I think at a very young age, I did see through a lot of that. And I saw a lot of the contradictions and the hypocrisy, but I also saw the benefit and the beauty and the... you know, the value. So I think I already had a little bit of an understanding of where I wanted to go and what I wanted to find. I wanted to find a spiritual practice that I could wrap myself, my mind around completely without those ambiguities and those contradictions and, you know, the stuff that I knew didn't belong there. You know what I mean?
Do you mean the rituals of the church? Or
yes, and the hypocrisy and the you know what I mean.
Mm.
There's a lot of judging and a lot of, you know.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Mm. Yeah, hypocrisy, very plain and simple. You know, live as Christ lived. Mm. Be kind, be compassionate. Yeah. And so, yeah.
And then you encountered yoga, and how long time did it take for you to become a teacher? Were you into that, did you know from the start that you wanted to be a teacher?
Yeah, well, I had been teaching dance, and I, even in my youth, I found myself tutoring and teaching. People came to me for advice as friends, and I was like, well, why me? But okay, I'll do my best. And I realized that it was just part of my nature, that I wanted to understand something so that I could fully invest. And the best way to do that is to approach it as if you were going to have to teach it. If I can teach it, I must have a deeper understanding. And so, yeah, I was almost immediately curious and interested in learning more, far beyond the asanas and the physical practice of yoga, but the whole of it. And I was fascinated with the way the whole thing operated and worked together, and realized from a very early stage that I could continue to work even yoga as I did my dancing. In other words, pushing myself beyond my limitations without the full understanding of the other limbs or the other elements of the practice, without the yamas, without the niyamas, without all of the other elements of yoga, it isn't yoga. And so I actually did, in the beginning, approach it as a physical practice, like physical fitness. And I even encountered it first at the gyms in New York. And so the environment, it was all about the sweat. It was all about pushing yourself and strengthening the physical body, which is not really yoga. It's not, definitely not the whole practice. And it's eliminating, like I said, the foundation, which are the first two limbs of the practice. I mean, the third limb of the Ashtanga yoga practice is the asana practice.
Yeah, because in the West it seems like we stress more, we point more to the physical mm-hmm. side, mm-hmm. like another form of training.
Yeah.
And what would you say is the most important thing with yoga besides the slow physical practice, which we knew is good because you feel your limitations mm-hmm. and you go slowly into the asanas and you can step back and if it's too rough for you, what would you say is the most, are the things that are not in the physical practice?
Well, first of all, for me, the yoga is an analogy for living and life. So the way we practice yoga is the way we live our lives. And so yoga practice doesn't end after Shavasana. You continue to practice yoga when you walk out of the studio and into your life. The whole idea that we're only practicing yoga when we're on the mat or when we're in an ashram in the mountains is naive and limited. I mean, the whole purpose of it is to have the ability to remain. I love this analogy. A guru said, if you can sit in the middle of Times Square and maintain focused and calm and non-stressed, you're practicing yoga. If you're in the mountains in a retreat, you're not faced with your challenge, with a challenge. You're actually taking yourself out of your life and controlling your condition, which we can't do in real life and in society. So we have to learn to stay centered within it. So for me, the most important thing is the whole idea that the practice never ends and it deepens and deepens, and that we want to approach our lives with the same philosophy. And in terms of the physical practice is that it is an opportunity to challenge ourselves and to observe the self. How you respond to the challenges and the limitations that the physical practice brings you is more important than the physical practice in itself. So opportunity to learn about yourself and how you respond and meet challenges mm-hmm. and how you treat yourself and how you treat your environment and your surroundings. This is the foundation.
Yeah. Is this hard to teach the students? Do they understand this concept?
This is probably the trickiest part of teaching, as far as I'm concerned, because not everyone is ready to hear you, but you keep trying. You can't force it down someone's throat. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. And if we try to put too much of the philosophy on people before they're ready, it may turn them off. And I think a lot of yoga teachers encounter this because they're making a living, they don't want to offend, they don't want to, you know, they want to keep everybody happy and coming back. So it's a balance, but that's yoga too. So as a teacher, that's an opportunity also to practice moderation, to practice nonviolence. It's not always what you say, but how you say it.
So you don't beat the students who are not behaving.
Exactly. And I mean, and understanding as a practitioner the principles behind.
Because you're quite a tough teacher. I took some private lessons with you, and I know you're quite tough.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I fail often. I mean, just as we do as human beings, I fail to maintain my center and my cool and my objectivity and my detachment often. So I have to continually check myself and say, damn, I wish I had said that differently, or I wish I had just let that go till next time, or whatever. So, and it's a constant practice as a teacher as well. It's an opportunity to practice yoga through your teaching, or through your physical practice, or at your job, or with your mother, who drives you absolutely crazy. But you know,
they do.
But we drive ourselves crazy, and that's why mom's driving me crazy, because I see myself within mom. And until I learn to accept and unconditionally love myself, I'm going to have trouble doing the same with others.
I am the master of the music.
I love it.
I think we should listen to David Sylvain. It's Fire in the Forest, so we can rest for 3 minutes.
My mind has been wandering, I hardly noticed. It's running on its own steam, I let it go. Oh, here comes my childhood, a penny for your secrets, and standing in the window, here where it belongs. There's a fire in the forest, taking down some trees. When things are overwhelming, I let them be. I would like to see you, it's lovely to see you. Come and take me somewhere, come take me out. There is always sunshine far above the gray sky. I know that I will find it, yes I will try. Yes, I will try. Yes, I will try.
Okay, it's David Sylvain. It's Fire in the Forest.
Fire in the Forest. Tim, I must ask you, you teach also gyrotonics. What is that? It sounds like gin and tonic.
Gin
or
and tonic. The gyrotonic expansion system. It's another movement modality that creates length and space, stretching and strengthening all the connective tissue. I also discovered it just around the same time as I discovered Pilates, in around 1991, after a serious knee injury and surgery. And it was truly responsible for taking me from 97% functionality back to about 100. So I was released from physical therapy, where they said, in all honesty, by our standards, you're rehabilitated, quote unquote, but you're not 100%, of course. And so if you want to get there, go try gyrotonics. And it worked. And so I've loved it, and I returned to it many times when I needed help, and finally realized how much of it I had incorporated even into my dance training and even into my yoga practice and all, and thought to myself, why aren't I teaching this? And I had been encouraged over the years as well by instructors of the method. To do that.
And where can we do this in Stockholm?
We have one of the apparatus at our place, Rikspecialisten, in Östermalm, and Greve Tyregatan. And there might be one or two other places in town. There's not much. Yeah. There isn't a lot in Scandinavia, but there's more and more. There are countries, ironically, for some reason or another, like Italy, France, Spain, England, that have a lot of gyrotonics. But of course, it started in the States, so there's a lot in New York.
Is this something that dancers or?
Everyone. Yeah. Although initially, I would say it did appeal to many, many, many dancers, and as does Pilates and yoga. You find a lot of ex-dance teachers in teaching those methods, and that can be an interesting, because it's bringing me back a little bit to where we left off before the break. That can be a bit of a handicap, in that one has to work a little bit against approaching it as we did dance, because as you mentioned, that toughness that I brought with me truly by habit from the dance world, get the leg up, get it going, get moved, it's, I have to let that go. So that in a way it works a bit against me, and it's an opportunity for me to look at myself and see what's my true intention in this moment. You know, is it about being right? Is it about showing what I know and what's right and wrong? Or is it about helping this person on their journey? You know, supporting, encouraging, getting them to breathe and calm down. Am I succeeding in that goal? Right? Because it's not about me, and it's not about right and wrong. What do I want at this moment? And I think that's the most important thing to keep in mind. With every breath we take, with every word we speak, with every action we take in life, what is my intention in this moment? Is it to prove, see, didn't I tell you I was right? Or is it to make peace with this person in this moment? Something that I think Donald Trump could learn.
Because you are an intense person by
absolutely,
nature.
Absolutely, by nature.
You are intense. You're passionate, burning energy.
Mm-hmm,
you're passionate.
Vata pita.
Vata pita, yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I need kapha. Yeah. And I need to remind myself very, very often. And what I also thought about in the break is that I am very conscious of this, and try to use that also in my teaching. So say I do something this week in practice that I look afterwards and think, oh, why? The next week I'll say, remember this last week when I said this and I did this? It really hurt me. It hurt me because that's not the way I wanted to react, or that's not the way I wanted to say it. And I don't believe it was effective, right? It wasn't in alignment with my true self and my higher self and my intention. So I would like to apologize, but I would also like to you to join me in observing that even my teaching is a journey and a practice, and we can see a deeper understanding of the yoga in my experience as well. So I try to share my shortcomings and things that happen in my daily life as well, in my relationships or in my work life, or my insecurities, my anxieties, and how I struggle daily, or not struggle daily, but work daily. Mm-hmm. Try not to struggle, try not to resist. Yeah, suffering and struggling is always related to resistance. Somehow we're resisting, whether it's the truth, we really know what we should be doing to help this situation, make the situation better, and we're not willing to do it for whatever reason. The ego is taking charge of our lives. You know, we're identifying with, I am these pecs, I am this house, I am this car, I am this job. You know, and that's not true. That's an illusion. We're pure consciousness. We're not this physical body. We aren't this voice. We aren't what we do. Right? We are pure consciousness, and that's what the whole aim of yoga is to connect with that higher self, that sense of self, the true self.
Yeah.
Behind the illusion, behind all the images and screens and ideas that filter our perspective of reality, whatever that is.
Yeah. So I would like to ask you about one thing. It's the fascia in the body.
Mm-hmm.
Many yoga teachers today talk about this tissue. Can you explain what is fascia and why is it so important for yoga?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not a doctor, obviously. But my understanding of fascia is that it is comprised of collagen and elastic fibers, tissue, that it, and it is covering all of the ligaments and tendons and bones and organs, and then it's also like a mesh. Yeah, I, from my understanding, as the fetus develops, it's like layer upon layer of fascia unfolding. So our entire structure is this intertwining fibers, yeah, and they rebuild on a daily basis.
And in Sweden, it's bindvävs.
Like a web, bin web. Exactly. Yeah, and so now we're approaching and understanding a little bit more how limited our understanding of movement or our way of thinking about movement in a very sort of linear way, you know, sagittally, horizontally, vertically, sort of this mechanical way of moving, whereas. And this brings you to gyrotonics, actually, whereas everything we really do is based on spiraling, right? If you look at the way that the arms and the legs and the trunk, the torso, moves, it moves in a spiraling fashion, right? So not only do we bend forward and back and from side to side, but we are also rotating. Everything is rotating. And so to incorporate, and in this is very kind of exciting and hot in the yoga world today, is we really are reevaluating and visualizing from another perspective on how important and how much spiraling there is in the yoga practice and how important it is.
And that we should not only stand in static postures, but move all the time.
Absolutely.
Keep
absolutely
moving.
And even with our idea of quote unquote static, I like to try to encourage people to imagine that even when you're in Ardha Chandrasana, for example, that it isn't static. It isn't held, but it's living, it's moving, it's breathing. So the energy is being directed in all these opposite planes. North, south, east, west, yeah, up, down, and you keep reaching from the center, from the bandhas, right, out, and there's no place within that line of energy where you're gripping or holding, but you feel like you are allowing that energy to reach out and through all the joints, so we don't lock the elbows or the knees or any of the joints, but we sort of elongate or lengthen, and that lengthening and elongation connects us to our center, where we find the seat, find the ease, find the breath, reconnect with the breath. It's when we're holding that we restrict the breath, we restrict the energy, the flow of energy, and that's when we start to struggle. And that's where the mind starts to go, holy crap, what's going on? So
what was the most difficult thing in your work as a yoga teacher? What's the most difficult thing to teach? I mean,
well, let me tell you the first thing that came to my mind is would be the same thing I would say about myself, is to control, learning to control the ego mind, the judging mind, right? To be a witness in our own experience so that we are not judging, we're just observing. That calms the ego mind and begins to bring us into direct experience, to presence ourselves and be free of that restricting ego mind. That's what keeps us locked into patterns of movement as well. So in Pilates, we work very much with that same idea of being so present with the breath and in the moment that you're not judging and thinking. And that way we can start to change movement patterns. So for the students, it's really being present and not allowing yourself to feel a sense of obligation to compete with yourself. What I did yesterday might not be appropriate for me today. Today I have to sense what is happening right now.
Maybe right I need to now. Lay down and rest.
Exactly. Mm. Right now maybe I need child's pose more than I need to stay in that posture for another breath. And it's all about, it takes you back to the foundation, as I said, ahimsa. For me, ahimsa, which is the first of the yamas, is probably the most important because really it does connect with and affect all of the other yamas and niyamas. If you are nonviolent, that doesn't just mean you don't hit other people or kill other people. It means that you're kind to yourself. You're kind to others. You say kind things. You do kind things. You practice yoga in a kind, gentle, productive way.
For listeners who don't know, what are the yamas and niyamas?
Mama, I mean, now you're challenging me.
You don't have to tell everyone, but what is
Well, I mean, in English, because the translation of the Sanskrit is very interesting because they have fewer words that mean more things, so it becomes very, very sort of figurative and it evokes the imagination, which I absolutely love. But basically, the yamas are nonviolence, truthfulness, non-stealing. Depending on how you interpret it, there's one which I like to call moderation in all things, and
not too many gin and tonics.
No. And non-hoarding, and non-hoarding can also, for me, it connects to the sense of identification. So if I have these things and I do these things, I become this or I am that. So we want to practice nonviolence in all the things that we say, do, and think. Our thoughts are productive. It's energy. It's all energy. We want to be truthful. And by being truthful in your practice, should I really be doing this handstand right now or headstand right now? Am I strong enough to support this without hurting myself? So being truthful, it's there too. It's
But it's also about how you live in this society, because this capitalist society encourages us to compete, mm-hmm. to buy, to consume.
Absolutely.
And we go to our modern temples, which are the shopping malls.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that's a real challenge for mm-hmm. every person to
mm-hmm.
to live in moderation, mm-hmm. to live in tranquility and peace and love.
Absolutely. As I said, it's so far so much easier if you're secluded in the mountains, where you only have vegan food and you have no temptations. Hmm. You are taken out of context. Yeah, well, of course it's easy to live moderately.
Yeah, and then you go to Kerala for a yoga retreat, and then you come back and then you continue your mm-hmm. your hectic consuming
mm-hmm.
competing mm-hmm. life.
But we have a choice of looking at that as, oh, it's better if I take myself out of this, or just as we do when we step on the mat, I can use this as an opportunity to strengthen my beliefs and my understanding. So I can use this challenge to make myself stronger.
But
right?
Isn't it also a lot about hormones? I mean, when we do the yoga,
sure.
we reach deep inside our mm-hmm. bodies, our tissue, our muscles,
absolutely.
Our ligaments, our joints, and we, without smoking one, we experience a kind of tranquility and focused
mm-hmm.
calm.
Absolutely.
So
and almost euphoria.
Euphoria, yeah. So we release a lot of natural hormones.
Absolutely. But by bringing the body into balance. And that's why, for me, I often say that unless you're practicing yoga with the proper intention, you can actually be doing yourself harm.
It I can like be stressing to a
exactly,
yoga class.
Exactly. You, if you're pushing and fighting and struggling to do it and make it happen and all of that, there's no moderation in that. There's no balance in that. So you're hurting yourself. You're committing, you're going against the concept of ahimsa.
But it's very hard as a yoga teacher, because you feel in the class, like yesterday I had a class and I really challenged my students and they were sweating and
mm-hmm.
and it's really a subtle balance between challenging the students and also giving them the tranquility.
Absolutely.
And it's hard to
but you can't give
to
we can't give it though, can we?
No, right. We can't give it.
And ultimately, on the break, I also
thought
about,
try to give it.
Should we try? Of course. But it isn't ultimately your responsibility, because it is the responsibility of the individual. But what we can do is offer the information, and so that they, because they have to make the choice, and they have to make the commitment and the intention. So I often start the class with fixing an intention and asking the individual to determine exactly what that intention will be for them. Just go with the first thing that comes to your mind, and then practice keeping that intention through your entire practice. And notice how difficult it is.
Yeah, but the intention.
And give yourself a break when you blow it.
But the intention might be just to go to another, instead of going to the grit class or going to the, you know, the
power yoga.
The power yeah. thing. You go to the class and you treat it as any other exercise. Mm-hmm. But that might be good for you too.
I mean, yeah. Try a restorative yin yoga class and see how difficult that is for you. That's why I love exploring as well, and I encourage students to try different styles of yoga and to try. I mean, it's great to have a practice that you're committed to, absolutely, because again, that's that sort of foundation. And for me, that's why the Ashtanga practice, I admire it so much. But I also believe that the Ashtanga practice can be harmful and difficult for certain people if they're not practicing yoga. It can be stressful. So we have to modify and we have to moderate.
Yeah, it's the music department coming with a song for Nina Simone.
Oh, we love Nina Simone.
Sun, Nina Simone in a remix by François Kvegorkian, I think, François Co.
That's Georgian or Armenian?
Yeah, I think it's from old Eastern Europe. I don't know, I can't say exactly where from. You asked me if I had some questions about life.
Yeah.
And I said I have a lot of questions about life.
So shoot.
Well, I would like to ask you, Tim, why Stockholm? Why?
Ah.
I know that you are fond of
winter.
Chillness and winter and so on from your time in Chicago. So.
A relationship brought me to Stockholm.
Ah.
We met in 2005.
Lucky us.
And well, thank you. Lucky me, actually, as well. And that was an opportunity for me also to take stock and reevaluate my life and make some difficult decisions, recommit to myself and my quality of life, and where I was going to, to get a more centered, to be more centered, to be more grounded, and to find more ease in my life. And would it be by staying where I was, continuing the life that I was leading, and passing up this opportunity to have something that I'd always wanted, and maybe denied myself, or ignored a need that I had that I ignored? And so it was just an opportunity for a win-win situation all the way around.
Fantastic. I have one question. Once you told me about when you was in a dance group and you went to the Soviet Union. That was kind of a crazy trip, wasn't it?
I was teaching. Yeah, I was teaching. It was a crazy trip. what are you getting at?
Well, I'm getting at the whole thing. I mean, it sounded like it wasn't really organized from the Soviet part.
Well, to say that it wasn't organized is a bit, unfair. It was not organized in the way that I would have organized it. That doesn't mean it wasn't organized. They were organized. They knew what they were doing. I just didn't know what I was supposed to be doing. But it was a great opportunity for me to relax into a situation that made me extremely uncomfortable and insecure, and to do my best to stay centered, which in the long run led me to a great experience and an understanding that they had it under control. It just didn't look like it from my perspective.
What was the difference?
Well, I mean, just... It's everything seemed chaotic and, you know, disorganized. I don't know. For example, I was standing in a line of 150 people trying to check into the hotel all at once, and there were no lines, there was no order, it was total chaos. And I got a call on my cell from the director saying, "Which gate are you at? Which gate are you at?"
Okay.
And it's like the person that he had organized to pick me up had already picked me up and brought me to the hotel. And so I was like, well, I'm checking in right now. And about an hour and a half later, I checked into my room. I got into my room and the phone rang, and it was a woman informing me that my class started at, let's say, 10:30 in the morning, and that there would be someone there at... I think it was 9:45 to pick us up. And how will this person look? Oh, well, you'll see them in the lobby. Well, there's 5 million people in the lobby. How will you really know? And then I said, okay, well, how long does it take to get to the location, the locale? Oh, depends. Could be 45 minutes, could be an hour, you know. And I'm like, well, my class starts at 10:30. Why, how, that's not... I would be late. I can't be late. If anything, I would like to be early so that I can focus and get grounded. Oh, well, I mean, it's up to you. If you want to, then you can go with the group that's leaving at 7:30 in the morning. And then I got to the location and found out that my class actually didn't start at 10:30. It started at 12:30. So I sat around from, 8 o'clock till 12:30. But, shit happens. And, rather than let it affect my attitude and my whole experience, and it turned out to be really great, and I actually did enjoy, and I found them to be very kind and very, but if we go into situations with resistance, and I've done it in the past where then I allowed whatever was happening that made me uncomfortable turn me into somebody resistant, and then it just affected me again, performing violence on myself.
Yeah.
Anyway.
One question I have for Kurt and me, we really love rhythm, and we think that the connection rhythm and yoga during our yoga DJ sessions are of course important. So, and as a dancer, how do you look upon the connection with yoga, and how can you incorporate rhythm and movement and make it more flowing? Do you use music?
I don't. Why? I don't. There's no real reason other than for me. I have to say that I personally love music so much, and music was a distraction for me as a child, I have to say. I mean, without getting too maudlin, I was insecure and unhappy and lonely as a child, and I retreated to music. So rather than going out into the world and having friends and doing whatever, I would come home and I would put my head between two speakers and blast the music and sing, and it was a survival technique. It actually got me through tough times, really tough times of being terrified and anxious and all that. So it was a, in a sense, it was a drug. So for me, I know that music could very easily become a distraction from my own brain noise and my own distractions, the distractions of my mind. And for me, the whole purpose of sitting on the mat is to allow those distractions and that brain noise, or allow my consciousness to become aware, allow myself to become aware of them, not to use another tool to distract me from them. I needed to learn to clear my head and not react to it, not identify with that brain noise, to just hear it and let it go. So that silence, which is very uncomfortable for a lot of people. That's probably my phone, I'm sorry. So that silence can actually be another challenge, and I think that that can be important. Someone else, you know, I don't say you shouldn't use it. As far as regarding the rhythm thing that you're talking about, absolutely, there must be a rhythm. I think you and the breath is determining the rhythm. And that link between the breath and the rhythm, because there is a music. I actually say that often. I want you to create the music, create the rhythm. There should be an internal rhythm to your practice. Inhaling up, exhaling down, inhaling to the next movement, exhaling to the next. So you follow that wave of your breath, attempting to calm and deepen it and lengthen it. And therefore, there is a music, there is a rhythm, and you are, because I do appreciate in dance how important it is to be able to arrive and come back from a movement in time to the rhythm. It's another challenge, you know what I mean? Having an obligation to be there and be here at a certain time. There's a bit, another, it's just another level of challenge. But that can be the breath. That can be that internal rhythm and that internal music. So you can't just say, well, get out of Chaturanga into Downward Dog whenever you get there. You know, there is an attempt to make it happen within that one breath and in a consistent rhythm with your Upward Dog, and with a consistent rhythm with swinging your leg through to Virabhadrasana A, with your swinging down into Chaturanga again. So you want to try to keep that steady rhythm, because as we fatigue, as we start to get tired and lose our strength, we could become indulgent and take our time getting there. And so again, it's that challenge to maintain your poise, maintain your breath, maintain the ease and the focus of the mind, which is starting to go, okay, if we do this one more time, I'm going to die. So maybe that means you need to rest in child's pose. Or maybe you can breathe through it and stay calm and not lose energy, not waste energy, panicking about, are we going to really do one more? I can remember back to my earlier days when I was pushing so much that halfway through class I was in a puddle wanting to die. And it's like, why? When other people near me are dry and calm. It's because I was working it to death. I was working it. Right? And that's what... So it was me. I had to learn that what it was about. Why am I doing this? Yeah. Mm. And what am I doing to myself in the process? I was thinking on the break, you were talking about approaching, you talked about hormones and how that, you know, those are affected as well. And absolutely, when one remembers and reminds oneself while they're practicing, this is not just a physical practice. Even though I'm doing the asanas right now, I am also affecting the energetic body, the emotional body, the physical body, the spiritual body, right? They're parallel. And so you can't separate them.
All right. We are almost on the...
On the edge of danger.
On the threshold. Yeah,
I might contradict myself at one point.
On the threshold of this. I would just like to take the opportunity to do some reklam för våra yogaklasser vid Telefonplan som vi har tisdagar, torsdagar och söndagar. Tisdagar med Niklas, torsdagar med Henrik och söndagar med mig, Christian. Så välkomna dit. Gå in på yesyoga.se.
And Tim, where do people find you if they want
to? Well, they find me in the Turkspecialisten in Stockholm, teaching, as I mentioned earlier, Pilates and gyrotonics, and I'm leading teaching Pilates and yoga. Right now I'm teaching somewhere between 30 and 35 hours of Pilates. It sort of has really taken off for us, so I am limited in what I can teach now with yoga. Teaching 40 hours a week is wow.
Yeah, just one last question.
Yeah, of course.
If you can just briefly describe what's the difference with Pilates and yoga. I mean, couldn't you incorporate Pilates movements into yoga and vice versa?
Well, first of all, if you really look at Pilates, you realize that Joseph Pilates, who created the method, he did incorporate movement that you will find in yoga, in dance, in swimming, in boxing. He really looked at the way that the human body, the demands that we place on the human body, and tried to understand how to make that as functional as possible. So there is that, in terms of that physical practice, there are overlaps and correlations. But if I was going to very briefly, in short, describe the difference, is that Pilates is a physical practice which yields wellness and spiritual benefits in the long run, whereas yoga is intended to be a spiritual practice which involves the physical and reaps physical, emotional, psychological benefits. So almost meeting from opposite spectrums or intentions, but they meet somewhere. It all meets somewhere. Just as I mentioned, those bodies, those physical, emotional, spiritual bodies, they're all intertwined, so they connect.
Great. So thank you so much for coming here.
Well, yeah, thank you for asking.
And I hope someone will listen to this out in the forest, maybe walk around the lake of Jerman by Kungens Kurva, which is almost like Canadian
one. Sergels Torg.
Maybe. Or out by the beaver land.
Beaver hut.
Kumelnäs, where you live.
My home, yeah. Well, I put on Bill Evans. Peace, peace.
Mm-hmm. Namaste.
Namaste.